Thank you, Judith, and thank you for this organization that thinks that thinking matters, even in religious context. I think I have to start with the story because of the introduction and the reference both to my silencing, but also to the man who's missing because he has a hip problem at 84 years of age. I think you'll enjoy this story. When I was about to be silenced by Cardinal Ratzinger for a year, I called my sister in Boulder because my mother was living in a retirement home in Boulder at the time. She was rather a new widow. And I called my sister and I said, well, here, this is coming down. It's going to be in the papers. Two questions. One, can Mom take it? And number two, can she keep a secret? Well, my sister said, she can take it, but she can't keep a secret. So I thought this over. So I flew out to Boulder to see my mom. I didn't want her to hear the news in the paper. So I sat down with her. My opening sentence was, Mom, how does it feel to be the mother of a somewhat controversial priest? Oh, she said, I walk out of Mass all the time. She said, I have a pact with your father. If the priest says really stupid things, I get up and walk out. I stay outside until Mass is over. We drive home together and we don't fight. We have this contract. And I said, Mom, when's the last time you did that? She said, three months before your father died. But I said, Mom, that's when you had that hip problem and you had that walker. Oh, yeah, she said. And I banged that thing as hard as I could. as hard as I could as I left church, she said, the nonsense that priest was saying, she said. So I just thought you'd enjoy that story. That's part of my upbringing. So I concluded my mom would have no trouble with what was coming down from the Vatican. And I was right. So I've been given an odd assignment. First time I've been told to give a talk based on one chapter of someone else's book. So I've wrestled with it, and I appreciate it because I like new challenges. And it's been a little bit of a challenge. So the topic I'm supposed to be talking about is what forgiveness is not. So I'll just remind you what Desmond Tutu and his daughter Mufu Tutu have written in this chapter. Then I'll go on from there and try to develop some ideas of my own. What forgiveness is not? Forgiveness is not easy. It requires hard work and a consistent willingness. Forgiveness is not weakness. It requires courage and strength. Forgiveness does not subvert justice. It creates space for justice to be enacted with a purity of purpose that does not include revenge. Forgiveness is not forgetting. It requires a fearless remembering of hurt. Finally, forgiveness is not quick. It can take several journeys through the cycles of remembering and grief before one can truly forgive and be free. So I say amen to all that, and then I will try to launch into a few more comments, some of which are really already alluded to in that summary. So I would say forgiveness is not something you do right away. We have to let the hurt, feel the loss, feel the grief, let the betrayal sink in. Because hurt goes very deep. Grief breaks the heart. And you're not really forgiving if you don't first taste what you have undergone. We have to taste the ashes. This is what the mystics mean by the dark night of the soul. That and our culture is not good at the dark night of the soul. We're told, well, George Bush's first words after 9/11 were, go shopping. That's so American, you see, that you don't want to deal with the hurt. You want to go do something and quit thinking about it, quit feeling. So in our culture, we're not just given shopping to do. We're given drink and drugs and football games and television and all kinds of addictions. And addictions interfere with the process of grief and with the experiencing of the deep hurt. So Eckhart is very strong about that too. Let go and let be. He says we sink eternally from letting go to letting go into God. So forgiveness is one expression of letting go. There are others, of course, too. So we have to register the full depth of the pain, to know, own it, and to name it before we can really let go. Otherwise, if we stop short in the process and we just leap into forgiveness, we, in fact, may end up wallowing in anger and bitterness. Thomas Aquinas says bitterness comes from holding anger in a long time. We've all met people who are bitter. And they're people who've not gone down deep enough into their grief, and the first level of grief is anger. So we also have to make room and safe space for that anger to play out. Another dimension of forgiveness, what forgiveness is not, is that forgiveness is really about the personal more than the structural. Let me say that again. You forgive persons, but structures, no matter what the Supreme Court says, structures and corporations are not people. They do not deserve our forgiveness. They deserve our reformation. They deserve being done over or dumped in that ash bin of history and moving on. It's called evolution. When Wall Street raped Main Street 8 years ago, and we're still suffering from that, and then Main Street bailed out Wall Street, it is not Main Street's job today to ask forgiveness from Wall Street. We ought to be critiquing what kind of economic system we're living in, which is making some people crazy rich, and I mean that literally, crazy rich and crazy powerful, while others cannot even get work or pay for their homes or college education, etc., etc. So we must not confuse, I think, forgiveness of the individual, of the of persons, with forgiveness of structures and ideologies. The same, of course, can be said of pedophilia in the Catholic Church. Again, a structure that consciously set out to protect the abusers in order to protect the so-called image of an institution. Shame, shame, shame. That does not need forgiveness. That needs reformation and cleaning up. And it does not need denial. So many Catholics still, and now that there's a halfway decent pope, I mean, maybe he's even a three-quarters way decent pope, many Catholics, including Catholic periodicals, are just trying to rush into, oh good, we can forget about the pedophilia. No, you can't. You talk to people who were abused as children, and this is a lifelong issue of grief and suffering, and we must not forget. And the institution that that covered this up needs to be addressed continually on the subject, even though it's not pleasant. We must remember that denial is not a virtue. Eckhart says, God is the denial of denial. In other words, as long as we're in denial, God cannot flow. Creativity cannot flow. And I fear that a certain amount of Catholicism is lurching back into denial, including so-called liberal Catholicism, such as America Magazine or National Catholic Reporter. A friend of mine has just written a marvelous book. If you're interested in this topic, which is a serious topic, you should look it up. He's a very interesting guy, Norbert Kraft. He's been twice the Poet Laureate of Indiana. And when he was a boy growing up in a small town in Indiana that was a German town and the German priest ran the town, he was abused by this priest, who was the hero of the town. His brothers were abused, one of them committed suicide, his friends were abused, the whole thing. And now he's written a book of poetry about the experience called Catholic Boy Blues. And I was asked to write the foreword to it. And it's a powerful book. It's in four parts. The first part is him as a boy talking to himself as a man. The second is his man talking to the boy, his boy, himself as a boy. The third is him talking to the priest. And the last is the priest talking back. He was saved by the blues. He lived in southern Indiana. When he was 12 or 13, he went wandering, and he ended up in a blues club. And it was the first experience that spoke to his broken soul. And he has always been in love with the blues, and he often does poetry readings with blues bands. But his book begins this way. His introduction, the first sentence is, "It's taken me 55 years to write this book, to admit this really happened to him and to tell the world." And of course, writing it was a healing process for him, but the main purpose of the book is that it be a healing process for others who have been abused. And not necessarily just by clergy. But you see, it's one thing to go legally against the abusive priest and the abusive diocese, etc. That's just one part of the mosaic. But the deeper thing is the soul. Getting $1 million settlement doesn't deal with the soul work. So if you're all interested in this topic, here's a man who's speaking truth to power. Get his book. And his poetry is like Maya Angelou's poetry. It's very simple, direct. All his other poems, he's written, 15 books and won lots of awards. It's all about the beauty of growing up in the land of Indiana. It's all very earthy and via positiva. A lot of it's via positiva poetry. It's wonderful stuff. But this is his telling of the story, his full story. And it's tragic, and yet it's also beautiful that he's had a full life. He's had a marriage. They've adopted a couple of kids. He had a good job teaching poetry in State New York University for many, many years. But it was in returning to Indiana, retired a few years ago, that all this came up again. And he and his spiritual director realized they had to tell the story, you see. So that's what we need to get over. And what I want to tell you is, America Magazine wouldn't review the book. And NCR has not reviewed the book. And that's why I'm telling you this stuff. So-called left-wing Catholicism is back to denial. Don't let them be. His name is Norbert Krapf, K-R-A-P-F. It's a German name. The name of the book, Catholic Boy Blues, is a beautiful title. And there's a picture on the cover of him when he was 9 years old, taken by that priest. And you get the cover itself, I have goosebumps. It's just, you can read the whole story in his eyes. So we need a lot more of that. And write a letter campaign to America Magazine and to NCR and say, when are you going to review this book? How many are you going to do that? Do it. Do it. You know, I was told by Judith that this is essentially a retirement community. Well, no, you're not. No, you're not. There's no such thing as retiring from life, especially at this critical time in history. I say we throw out the word retirement. It's an obscene word. There's no such thing. Refirement is the word. Refirement. Get your fire. Ask the universe, where's my fire? What do I do with the years I have, with the experience I have, the contacts I have, the resources I have? You could all sit down and write a short letter to America Magazine and say, why the hell aren't you reviewing this book? Are you stuck in denial again? Are you hiding behind the petticoats of the new pope because he's a good pope? That does not, that does not resolve these issues. Truth is tougher than that. Number four. Forgiveness is not a sort of altruism. Rather, it is an act of healthy self-love. But how much do we know about healthy self-love if we have internalized our own oppression? If we have been believing the bad news, for example, the bad news of original sin, and playing it out in our lifetimes. Therefore, forgiveness is ridding ourselves of internalized oppression, throwing off the bad news we've been fed about ourselves. For example, are we able to forgive ourselves for being human? Are we able to forgive ourselves for being mystics and lovers? I suspect a lot of people can't, because they don't progress and mature to that level. And yet we're all capable of this, of being mystics and lovers. That's why I wrote my new book on Meister Eckhart, Mystic Warrior for Our Times. Mystics are not isolated freaks of spiritual genius. There's a mystic in every one of us. And it's not too late to stir those waters. What the mystic is a lover. Can we free ourselves and forgive ourselves for being prophets and warriors called to interfere? Yes, even in our later years. Not only as refirement takes hold again, but also rewirement. You see, often if you lived a professional life and so forth, a life of parent, grandparent, you've been busy. But rewirement, I think, is precisely bringing that mystic in you alive. Because we're all wired for mysticism. Check it out. Check out the history of our species. Check out how our earliest ancestors were in awe and wonder looking up at the stars and the seasons. Check out how Stonehenge happened. How is it possible that humans, before the wheel was invented, dragged 100-ton rocks to set up what? To set up a ritual center that was organized around the solstice of the winter and the summer seasons. Notice, our ancestors were into a cosmological relationship. And it got them out of their couches. They weren't sitting around watching television or addicted to the internet. They did something together that was important. And then important to them and their souls. And it was connecting to their place in the universe. Now today, when we know so much more about the universe, it's up the ante. It's quadrupled. It's squared the meaning of awe and wonder to learn that we've been on a 13.8 billion year journey getting here. And that here is a universe of hundreds of billions of galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars. And that here in our galaxy, a star is being born every 15 seconds. Don't ever tell anyone you're bored again. And don't allow your kids or grandkids to have that attitude. There's so much going on. Can we forgive ourselves for being women? Can we forgive ourselves for being divorced? For being men? For being heterosexual? For being homosexual? For striving for eternity, for being mortal, for being a spark of God. Meister Eckhart talks a lot about our being sparks of God. And one of the really interesting points to his teaching this is that in 13 different sermons, he gives credit for the phrase spark of God to Avicenna. Avicenna was a Muslim philosopher. He lived 200 years before Eckhart. Now Eckhart lived from 1260 to 1329. He was 13 years old when Rumi died, 17 years old when Thomas Aquinas died, who was also a Dominican like Eckhart and me. And Eckhart was condemned a week after he died, in 1329. And Eckhart was 20 years old when Mechthild of Magdeburg died, a great Beguine, the Beguines being the women's movement of the Middle Ages. And Eckhart was a fierce supporter of the women's movement of his day. The Pope John XXII, who ended up condemning Eckhart, condemned the Beguines 17 different times. Out, damn spot. It obviously wasn't sticking, you know. 17 different times. And when the Pope died, there were a million Beguines all over Northern Europe. The Beguines were women who chose not to be married and not to be nuns in a cloister, which is the only kind of nun you had back then. And there were many of them were lower class, so they couldn't even be nuns. To be in many nuns, like Hildegard's monastery a century earlier, you had to be upper class. You had to bring a dowry. But so these women created their own lifestyle. They lived together in small communities. They made a living as weavers and sewers. And they served the sick and the poor and the young. And they also worked as craftspeople, creating stained glass and so forth. And they begged Franciscans and Dominicans, who were a new movement at that time, to be their teachers. And Eckhart was one of those teachers. And he hung out with them and they with him. And that's why he is as feminist in his language, brings in the divine feminine so much. One example being his phrase, "What does God do all day long? God lies on a maternity bed giving birth." So I have a whole chapter in here. We'll have two chapters with Eckhart on the Beguines in his relationship. Now, latest scholarship has shown there is a particular Beguine who wrote a book in the 13th century. And she was burned at the stake in 1310 in Paris. And Marguerite Perret is her name. And Eckhart returned to Paris in 1311, but he only stayed 1 year. And he stayed in the very convent where the inquisitor who burned Marguerite Perret at the stake lived, a Dominican. I have no doubt why Eckhart skipped town after 1 year, but I think he skipped town with her book. Because we have now found that there are quotes in Eckhart's sermons straight from Marguerite Perret's books. The book that was burned. And that shows two things. First of all, how much respect he had for her teaching. But secondly, how much courage he had to sneak her teaching, she who had been burned at the stake, to sneak it into his sermons, to keep her thinking alive, if not her body. So Eckhart, in speaking of spark of the soul, there's a wonderful passage in Rumi. Again, Rumi died just when Eckhart was 13, about the spark of the soul. He says, "Ah, one spark flew and burned the house of my heart. Smoke filled the sky. The flames grew fierce in the wind. The fire of the heart is not easily lit." Now, this applies to refirement, you see. You have to ask the universe, what is the fire in my belly now? And I would propose that probably for 95% of you, it has something to do with the youngest generation. What are we leaving behind for the great-great-grandchildren to come? "The fire of the heart is not easily lit. So don't cry out, O Lord, rescue me from the burning flames. Spare me from the army of thoughts marching through my mind. O heart of pure consciousness, you are the ruler of all hearts. After countless ages, you brought my soul all it ever wished for." Eckhart says a spark of the soul is that part of you that never dies. It does not die. It never goes out. And it is, he says, that sometimes he says, it's the Holy Spirit in us. And other times he says, it's the manger in us where the Christ is born continuously. Because Christ is always needing to be born. He says, we are all mothers of God because the Christ is always needed to be born. You see, what's so powerful in Eckhart's theology is that he does not equate Jesus and Christ. He has the cosmic Christ tradition that we are all other Christs. Every being is a Christ. And Jesus showed us this. And we have to get back to this very ancient teaching. John Shelby Spong, the Episcopal bishop who gets in a lot of trouble for minor reform Christianity. He said about this book on Eckhart, a stunning new vision of Christianity that transcends both creeds and boundaries and is a thrilling read. But I was surprised when he said, a stunning new vision. Eckhart gets his vision from the first century, from the cosmic Christ, which was what the first century teaching of Jesus was all about. Paul, the first writer in the Christian Bible and the first theologian, goes on and on about the Christ who holds everything together in the heavens and the earth. But we have forgotten that dimension as we become more and more anthropocentric, more and more cut off from the universe, and more narcissistic. And this is exactly what has to change today. And because we're getting a new cosmology from science that is laced with awe and wonder and radical amazement, we are in a position as a species to finally wake up again. And Eckhart is such a fine guide in this process, because for him, as for most pre-modern thinkers, our place in the cosmos matters. This is where we get our energy. This is what drove those ancient Britons to build the Stonehenge, or the Newgrange monument, which is older than the pyramids in Ireland. It is about our relationship to the universe, our mother. Can we forgive ourselves then for being another Christ? For truly being a son and daughter of God, and not just projecting that onto one person named Jesus. Take our responsibility back, our dignity back. Can we forgive ourselves for being joyful? Notice that word joyful. It's like thankful. You're not half full of joy or half full of thanks. You're either full and overflowing of thanks and full and overflowing of joy, or you haven't tasted joy yet. So you haven't forgiven yourself for your capacity for joy. Can we forgive ourselves for a capacity for emptiness, experience of nothingness, of no being? Eckhart says, I once had a dream. Even though I am a man, I dreamt I was pregnant. I was pregnant with nothingness. And out of that nothingness, God was born. Carolyn Crist wrote a fine book on feminist spirituality a number of years ago, and each chapter is a different writer, a different woman writer. One of them is Adrienne Rich. And she concludes in her last chapter, she summarized, number one, every single one of these women writers, many of them novelists, talks about nothingness. It's a woman's experience. It's also a man's experience. But who gives us permission in our culture to talk about nothingness? Well, Eckhart does. Eckhart does it all the time. The mystics do. They go to the edge. And we have to taste the whole enchilada, including nothingness and including wholeness and fullness. Can we forgive ourselves for being old? Can we forgive ourselves for being young? Especially when we're old. Now, what I'd like to do is to focus in on one dimension especially that's really emerging in the news in our culture at this time. And that is men being forgiven for being men. We've been hearing about these NFL football players beating up their wives-to-be and their children. This is an educational moment. This is very important. Football is a big part of our culture. And what's beautiful is to see and hear some of the peers and the playmates, co-workers of these professional players, speaking out and saying, you do not treat women this way, you do not treat children this way. Of course, there's this big cover-up going on, as there was when the Vatican News broke out about pedophilia too. The organization, the institution, doesn't want to rock its economic boat. But it's interesting, though, the press has gotten hold of it, and all kinds of people are keeping their toes to the fire, which is excellent, or feet to the fire, which is excellent. But I want to go deeper. There was an article this past week, a week ago, by William Pollack and Jennifer Siebel Newsom that ran in the San Francisco Chronicle. Pollack is the author of the book Real Boys, an associate clinical professor at Harvard Medical School. Jennifer Siebel is founder and CEO of the Representation Project, a documentary filmmaker, and her latest film is The Mask You Live In, exploring the ways in which America's narrow definition of masculinity is harming boys, men, and society at large. So you see, I think this moment in our cultural history is an educational moment. Most crises are. I think the collapse of our economic system 8 years ago was such a moment, and I don't think that we took advantage at all. We've been putting Band-Aids on Wall Street instead of asking the deeper questions. Can't we come up with an economic system that works for everyone? Duh! Are we smart enough to do that? Of course we are. And there are people who devoted their life to that, like David Corten, K-O-R-T-E-N. He has developed an economics that will work for everyone on the planet, not just the two-legged ones, but the forests and the oceans and the four-legged ones who are suffering as much as everyone else from the economic system we're in. But here's something they say in their article about the abuse that men are involved in. For one thing, suicide. That boys are 5 times more likely to commit suicide than girls. Depression in boys tends to initially manifest itself in early stages. Boys are more likely to act out, be aggressive, and engage in risky activities. So the early warning signs of depression in boys are often missed, leading to a misdiagnosis as a conduct disorder or attention deficit disorder. So you see, boys are not well understood in our culture, and they get a message real early, don't cry. In other words, don't get in touch with your feelings. That's a very dangerous message. Young men average 3 suicides a day in the United States. They say depression in males of all ages is a public health crisis that must be addressed. To do so, we must redefine healthy masculinity and recognize that even if men are putting on a face suggesting everything is fine, real pain may be lurking beneath the surface. Notice, though, what they're naming. Our definition of masculinity is the core problem. Now, I wrote a book 2 or 3 years ago called The Hidden Spirituality of Men, 10 Metaphors to Awaken the Sacred Masculine. Because I've sensed this for years, how depressed men are. And and of course, sometimes it just comes out as sadness and disgruntlement. But sometimes it will come out as aggression. And of course, suicide is aggression to oneself. But this other aggression we're reading about now, you know, people are saying, oh, well, this football player named Rice beat his girlfriend up, is now his wife, but it's only one isolated case. No, they've counted at least 56 other cases in the National Football League in the last few years of these football players beating up their girlfriends or their wives. And, of course, when the 49ers fellow, McDonald, facing trial on it right now. So I think it's terribly important that all of us, men, women, young and old, be putting these questions out there. What is healthy masculinity? Now, when I wrote that book, the very first response was an email from a woman. And she said this to me. She said, in my home library, I have over 200 books on the goddess. And not one book on the sacred masculine. And I have 2 teenage sons. And she said, until I read your book, I didn't realize how much men have suffered under patriarchy. And now I understand. But she said, I do not regret for a minute the last 40 years of my life where I have sought out the goddess and sought out the mystery of my womanhood. But now I agree with you. To be an authentic feminist, I have to work on the men issue as well. And of course, if you're all Jungian, you know that the human soul is half feminine, half masculine, whether you're a boy or a girl or a man or a woman. And what that means then is that women are walking around with a toxic masculinity in their souls, as well as men. And a healthy man welcomes the goddess, the return of the divine feminine. And a healthy institution does too, which is why the Catholic Church and even this present Pope have miles to go. So this is everybody's business. Health, how we define masculinity. And this is a teaching moment for all of us. What's coming out in the press about these individuals. Now, there was an amazing article a few days ago written by a guy who almost joined ISIS, a jihadist movement, young American man. And what he says, he did go over to Asia to study, to be a jihadist with fundamentalist Muslims. And he said that, in fact, I was taught that I could achieve more good in the world as a scholar than as a soldier. That Muhammad said that the ink of scholars was holier than the blood of martyrs. That's a pretty damn good teaching. That should be on banners. But here's what he wrote in this article. The essence of his argument is this. What really drove him to, what tempted him to join the jihad and ISIS, he says, was not Muhammad philosophy. Instead, he felt, as a young man, it was a very, very American thing to do. And I quote, "We are raised to love violence and view military conquest as a benevolent act. The American kid who wants to intervene in another nation's civil war owes his worldview as much to American exceptionalism as to jihadist interpretations of scriptures. I grew up in a country that glorifies military sacrifice and feels entitled to rebuild other societies according to its own vision. I internalized these values before ever thinking about religion. Before I even knew what a Muslim was, let alone concepts such as jihad or an Islamic state, my American life had taught me that that's what brave men do." This is a stunning statement. You see, young men are very vulnerable. You know, young men don't grow up as quickly as young women. Biologically, their brains do not develop as rapidly as women's brains. In the ancient cultures, like the Aboriginals of Australia, which are probably the oldest tribe on the planet, they say that girls can get married at 15 or 16, but boys cannot get married till they're 27. Because men don't know what life is about till at least 27 years of age. Now that ancient wisdom rings a few bells. But notice that what we're also saying is how vulnerable young men are to messages. And the question, it's an important question, what is a man? What is masculinity? And the point is that our culture is feeding him. It's win-lose. You see, it's the reptilian brain. That's really what our culture is saying. We're number one. That's the goal in football, and it's a goal in business, the business of football and every other business, unless we step back like Anita Roddick did and look for other values to go along with it, like the survival of the planet, not a bad idea, or community, not a bad idea, and maybe putting people to work instead of squeezing out every damn dollar for shareholders and stockholders that you can by throwing off workers willy-nilly. Maybe that's a value. Who the hell's going to stand up for that? Let's get out of denial. This current version of capitalism is obscene, and it's sick, and it's immoral, and it's unjust. We should get out of our couches and start doing something. And don't tell me you're too old. You're not. You can write letters to editors. You can call into talk shows. You can kick ass. That's what prophets do. It's what Jesus did. Jesus never said, "Blessed are the comfortable," sipping their tea under a lemon tree in Santa Barbara. Jesus never said that. Buddha never said that. We're here for serious purposes, folks. It's about living fully and loving fully and leaving a planet that's healthy and grandchildren. Men behaving badly. Men behaving badly. What an important moment this is to ask these serious questions. I have a chapter in my Eckhart book on Adrian Rich. I put Eckhart in this book in the room with Thich Nhat Hanh to show his Buddhist side, and he's very Buddhist, though he never read a Buddhist in his life and never read a Buddhist book in his life. He was a Christian, but he went so deep into his own soul and his own lineage that he comes up talking like a Buddhist. The Buddhists claim him as a Buddhist. Dr. Suzuki, the Japanese Buddhist philosopher, was in a dialogue with Tom Merton, the Catholic monk, 1959. When it was over, Suzuki said, "Tom, you're a typical Western dualist. The only outside chance you have of getting Buddhism is to read your one Zen thinker of the West, Meister Eckhart." And Merton said, "Well, Eckhart's been condemned by the church." And Suzuki said, "Well, I can't help that, can I?" The next year, Merton did one thing. He read Zen and he read Eckhart. And his life switched 180 degrees from being a guilt-ridden, dualistic, Augustinian monk of the 50s to being the prophetic Christian he became in the 60s. And in his final Asian journal, which he was writing as he went east and died east, he was writing in the note on the side, "Eckhart is my lifeboat. Eckhart is my lifeboat." So here we have Suzuki saying Eckhart is a Buddhist. And he is. I hold passages in Eckhart that sound like pure Buddhism. And Thich Nhat Hanh and Eckhart agree on all kinds of things. So I have a chapter on Kumaraswamy, the Hindu, who in the 1930s wrote a book, Nature and Art, and a chapter on Eckhart. And he says, "Reading Eckhart is like reading the Upanishads." That is the ultimate compliment from a Hindu. He says, "Whole sentences in Eckhart feel like they're translated from the Sanskrit." Amazing. My first book on Eckhart, which is a big one with 38 of his sermons and a commentary after each, the first response I got was a package in the mail from a Sufi. He said, "Eckhart is a Sufi." And the package was a 12-page exegesis of one of Eckhart's paragraphs, short paragraph, and he just went on and on. As a Sufi, he exegeted Eckhart's sermon. So Eckhart is a Sufi. And I have a chapter on Eckhart and Black Elk. Eckhart as a shaman. Now this is why Eckhart is so stunningly appropriate for our times. I don't know anyone living or dead who has, from the West, who's gone so deeply that he's absolutely so broad that Buddhists can call him a Buddhist, Hindus can call him a Hindu, shamans can call him a shaman, and Sufis can call him a Sufi. Now I have a chapter on Eckhart and Adrienne Rich, because Adrienne Rich is one of my favorite feminist writers. She's deceased now, poet and prose writer. But I reread her stuff in writing this book, and it's as delicious and pertinent today as it ever was. But here is one thing she says about men. My Adrienne Rich was a lesbian out in the 70s, which was a very brave thing to be, and she had two teenage boys. So she is a mother of two sons. And she says this, "What do we want for our sons? To discover new ways of being men, even as we are discovering new ways of being women. A manhood in which they would not perceive women as the sole source of nourishment and solace." In other words, men discovering their own compassion, the powers to give and to receive compassion. These fathers barely exist as yet. Well, I think there have been a lot more since he wrote those words. She wrote those words 30 years ago, thank God. She says, "If I could have one wish for my own sons, it is that they should have the courage of women. I mean by this something very concrete and precise. The courage I have seen in women who in their private and public lives, both in their interior world of their dreaming, thinking, and caring, in the outer world of patriarchy, are taking greater and greater risks, both psychic and physical, in the evolution of a new vision. I would like my sons not to shrink from this kind of pain, not to settle for the old male defenses, including that of a fatalistic self-hatred. What a line. A fatalistic self-hatred. Suicide, anyone? Original sin? Fatalistic self-hatred? Why did the Vatican so overreact to this book, Original Blessing? Even when it got translated into Polish, I felt, oh boy, now the Pope will get it. Because they're married to fatalistic self-hatred. That is the, and they call it original sin. Is your original sin being woman? Is your original sin being gay? Is your original sin being a person of color? Is your original sin being a man? Fatalistic self-hatred. How do you clean that up? How do you detox that? Well, that's what I try to do in my book on the hidden spirituality of men. I take 10 archetypes of healthy manhood. Green man, blue man, father sky, spiritual warrior, hunter-gatherer. And these archetypes are for women as well as men. This is for the man and you, you women. And it's for the man inside the men. And I'll tell you, a response I had in addition to that woman who was the first responder was from a Native American who came to me at a conference. He said, I work in prisons, been working in prison for 12 years. He said, men in prison are notorious at projecting on others. They don't want to look inside. For 12 years, I've tried to find a book that would get these men in prison to look inside. And he said, yours is the first book that works. I take them through those archetypes, and he said, they discover the nobility inside. I have goosebumps. That is so beautiful. That's what we have to do with our young men, our boys, and our older men. Assist them to find the nobility inside. Another word for nobility inside is original blessing, or the spark of God, or the cosmic Christ. And you must understand, we've built a whole civilization on original sin. Original sin is not just a theological category, it's what consumer capitalism is all about. Because the one message is, you don't have what it takes. Your teeth aren't white enough, your refrigerator isn't new enough, your car isn't fast enough. You got to get outside redemption. The whole enterprise of modern capitalism is based on original sin ideology. And contrary to what Hildegard of Bingen taught in the 12th century when she said, everything that is necessary for life is within us. It's already here. You don't have to get in a squirrel cage to redeem yourself, if you will, or to legitimize your existence. You're already a blessing. So, let me just finish up here. Forgiveness is not a denial of differences. It's in fact acknowledging differences in yourself, because that's where self-love begins. But also then, you can recognize it in others and celebrate what the French say, vive la différence. Celebrate the differences. Forgiveness is not taking on guilt and wallowing in it. Forgiveness is not living out shame and wallowing in that. And a lot of men are surrounded in shame. That's one reason they're so silent about their inner life. They don't have a language for what I've been talking about today. They don't have a language for how beautiful they are inside. But the language is there. These archetypes are part of that language. And the mystics are very much part of that language. There's a little talk of being with in our culture and in our religions. Let me share one more example from Eckhart. It's in my chapter on Eckhart and shamanism. And what he says about our relationship to other creatures. Because often men get most deeply in touch with their spirituality when they're in nature. You know, a lot of these hunting trips and fishing trips aren't really about hunting and fishing. They're about getting into nature. But you're not rewarded as a man for saying, oh, I'm a mystic and a contemplative and I have to go out and fish and be silent in a boat. And I don't really care if I bring home the bacon or not. You're not allowed to say those things out loud. But that's the truth of most men. Eckhart said, God poured the divine being in equal measure to all creatures, to each as much as it can receive. This is a good lesson for us, that we should love all creatures equally with everything we have received from God. God loves all creatures equally and fills them with the divine being. And we should lovingly meet all creatures in the same way. We find this attitude among the pagans. How many Christian preachers have you heard the last 2,000 years who are praising the pagans for their wisdom? We find this attitude among the pagans, people who came to the sense of love-filled equanimity. Love-filled equanimity. What a marvelous phrase. Through the knowing faculties given them by their basic human nature. It is a pagan teacher who tells us that a human being is an animal which is naturally gentle. So, the rediscovery of our equality at the level of being and living with all the other beings, the stones, the plants, the animals. That is the recovery of the sense of the sacred that has to light a fire to the ecological movement today. This is why we need this kind of creation-centered spirituality at this critical time in planetary history. And Eckhart had, he says, if I was feeling afraid and alone in the desert, I would like to have an animal with me, preferably a dog. Because equality gives strength in all things. You see, for him, your dog, your cat, you're equal at the level of being, at the level of playing, at the level of life. And that's why you receive strength from being with these creatures. And men know this. But they've not been taught it. They've not been encouraged to say it and to live it. And this is why we are on the cusp of opening up the doors to an ancient spirituality. It is a spirituality of the original historical Jesus, because he comes from the wisdom tradition of Israel, which is a creation-centered tradition, which does not get all its answers from the Bible, but from nature. Nature as revelation is the tradition of wisdom in the Jewish tradition. The tradition of the image of God is not that we humans are the only ones who are images of God, but that all creatures are an image of God, a spark of God. And Eckhart said that. Every creature is a word of God, he said, a logos. The Christ, therefore. Every creature is a logos, a word of God, and a book about God. He said, if I spent enough time with a caterpillar, I'd never have to prepare a sermon. Because one caterpillar is so full of God. And of course, a caterpillar is a very wondrous creature. It spins its cocoon and it becomes something else. A beautiful butterfly, but only for a short time. Is it 9 days or something? So, there's so much going on in our time. And one thing I want to tell you as I close. Well, we'll break and then we get to talk. But I had the privilege this past year to meet a very interesting woman. Lorna Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E. How have you heard of Lorna Byrne? Wow. Check her out. Look her up on her webpage. Lorna Byrne is a 61-year-old Irish peasant woman. She's illiterate. Her earliest memory, when she was 2 years old, lying on her back, looking up at her parents, was seeing her parents and their guardian angel behind each. Her whole life, she's been seeing angels and communicating with them. Growing up in Western Ireland, rural Ireland, the doctors or the teachers said she was, quote, an idiot. She was dyslexic. They said she's a, quote, idiot. So the teachers didn't bother to teach her to read and write. So she would sit in the corner. Everyone else was learning to read and write. But she was happy. She was talking with her angels. She said it took her years to figure out that others don't see angels all the time like she does. When she was 10, an angel, Michael, told her, one day you're going to write books and be famous. And she laughed at him because she could neither read about a book, or much less write a book. Well, they also told her, don't tell anyone until we give you the word. Only after her husband died 6 years ago did she come out of the closet. And she dictated three books. Didn't write them, but dictated them, which have become bestsellers, translated into 26 languages. And it's about the messages she'd gotten from these angels. And I interviewed her last year at Grace Cathedral, because she doesn't like to give talks, she likes to be interviewed. And there were about 1,200 people there. And one of the things she said was, there are a lot of unemployed angels in the world today. And I stopped her right there, and I said, what? I said, I know a lot of unemployed people. Now do we have to start employing angels too? No, she said, here's the deal. She said, God is pouring angels on the earth today to help us because we're in so much trouble. But no one's asking them for help. So they're unemployed angels. So this is something you can do too. You can call on the angels to help. Not just you. And don't think just in terms of your getting across the street safely. Think bigger than that. Think about angels to assist the young ones today who are facing such massive issues of global collapse, of drought, which you know about here in Santa Barbara, and all the rest. I have a friend who on his 50th birthday a year ago went to Mount Kilimanjaro, to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. When he got to the top, he wept because the snows are melting so fast there, and that mountain supplies water for most of the rivers of Eastern Africa. Same thing's happening in the Himalayas. The things are melting so fast, and that water supplies rivers for most of Southeast Asia, where most of the human race lives. We have a governor in the state of Florida who says, what, me worry? There's no global climate change? But I have a friend in Miami, which is also Florida, who tells me, you go to South Miami today, I walk down the street, there are 6 inches of water on the sidewalks. Miami is already going under. And the governor, in complete denial, just like Ratzinger was running his organization, what, me worry? You know, let's get a little smarter and a little angrier. Let's tap into that moral outrage that every prophet carries, that every warrior carries. And it's not about screaming at people. It's not about denouncing individuals, but it is about waking people up. That's what spirituality is about. Let me close with a poem about waking up from a friend of mine, Drew Dillinger, a rapper in the Bay Area. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing, or as the mammals, reptiles, birds were all dying. Did you fill the streets with protest when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew? That's the prophetic question. And a truly grown-up Christian or any other spiritual person is both a lover, a mystic, and a prophet or a warrior, one who defends what we cherish or say we cherish. Amen. Thank you. Okay.